Thank you, Charles, woven your magic. Now, as we look at these readings that are set for the Transfiguration, in particular as they're presented to us in the Gospel of Luke, I want to highlight some of the distinctive things about how Luke presents this episode. There's an account of the Transfiguration in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and each of them has their own particular highlights, things that they have focused on. So in preparing for this, I set myself the task of just what were the things that Luke really brings into this remarkable scene. And I'm doing it very intentionally, building on Charles's sermon last week, which was Luke's account of the Sermon on the Plain, very similar to the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew's Gospel, whether it's the same occasion or whether Jesus used the same teachings in different locations, it doesn't really matter. We can be sure that this is very much part of Jesus' teaching. And I remember Charles last week started by saying that he had some difficulty in reflecting on the teaching of the Sermon on the Plain, not because it was hard to understand. It is easy to understand. The challenge is to live into it, to try and give life to it, because it sets such a challenging but also hopeful picture of how things might be. But we are all too aware not just that that is not true of our world, it's also not true of ourselves. Charles used that quote from Schultzenitzkin that the line that separates good from evil runs through our own hearts, not just in the wider world. In some ways, this episode from Luke 9 and Luke's account of the Transfiguration that we've just heard is sort of the opposite. It's actually really hard to understand what's going on here, but the message that we can take away from it is actually comforting, very comforting. So that's where I want to sort of take us in our thoughts this week. Anyone looked at the news in the last 24 hours? The right-hand side is actually obliterated with one of the quotes. It does it occasionally with the formatting. The quote says, "There are decades when nothing happens, and there are weeks where a decade seems to have happened." There are decades when nothing happens, and then there are weeks when a decade happens. And that's sort of the week we've just had, I think, as people were processing what has been going on in significant matters of world order. The quote supposedly goes back to Lenin, but actually there's no evidence that it was actually attributed to that. It was just added as a thought at a later stage. But the truth behind it, I think, is very true. We are living in very unsettled times. Winston Churchill has many great quotes. He was renowned for his ability to say really pithy sayings. And this is one of Churchill's quotes about politicians, of which he, of course, is a quintessential politician. "A politician needs the ability to foretell what is going to happen tomorrow, next week, next month, and next year, and to have the ability to afterwards to explain why it didn't happen." And there's a profound truth behind that. But in that space, we ask ourselves, whom do we trust? Now, let me just explain a little bit about a phrase that's commonly used, usually by politicians, about the church, where they talk about the separation of church and state. Politicians will tell you that usually means that the church shouldn't comment on the realm of politics. That is actually not the case. Even in our biblical records, we can see that Jesus commented on Herod and the wider affairs of the regime at the time. What the phrase, the separation of church and state, is, it means that the state shouldn't be appointing leaders of the church. So you might be aware in when an established church that the state often makes the appointments. The phrase separation of church and state is that the state should not be telling the church how to be about going about its mission and ministry. I say that because I'm going to tiptoe into some areas of political reflection in the light of events of the last 48 hours. And it's not the practice for the Anglican Church to commend one party over another or anything like that. But I would say, in an election year, we need to be very wary of voices encouraging supremacy, especially the far-right supremacist. It worries me that state actors are encouraging that far-right movement in Europe, and we're told we'll be doing so within Australia. Supremacy, and even a form of nationalism, is actually not biblical. In fact, the gospel is counter to that. We need to beware of such voices. In that space, we have the teachings of Jesus that commends another way to power, to control, and even to the political realm. We pray deeply for Christians involved in our political processes. They are very, very necessary. And I have no doubt that it is incredibly hard to navigate pressures that are used in that space. But we need to be mindful that the vision of the kingdom knows no cultural boundaries. It knows no national boundaries. In fact, as Charles mentioned last week, urges us to reach out to pray for our enemies and for those who are different to us, those who are others, those who are outside, those who are the sojourners, and to receive them. It is a way of peace. So in that context, we have to ask ourselves the question, and in an election year, we ask ourselves the political question, who do we trust? Now, this is the ranking according to a survey back in 2019. And it rates those who are most trusted in our wider community and those who are least trusted. The blue column are those who are most trusted. The red column are those who are least trusted. Top of the list are doctors, scientists, teachers, those in the armed forces, and so on. Middle ranking, right in the middle there, is clergy and priests. And as you go down, the list goes through. Below the clergy and priests are television news readers, lawyers, business leaders, journalists, bankers, government ministers, politicians generally. What really intrigued me were pollsters, because this has actually come from a poll, and advertising executives. We are in a world where we do have to ask ourselves, what is the agenda here? Who can we trust? And that seems to be the big thing that has emerged coming out of the last 48 hours. The whole question about trust of people who say that we are a friend, we are an ally, we will be there for you. They are significant questions. So where does this take us? Let me just draw back to looking at how Luke has been telling his narrative. He started the public ministry of Jesus in the synagogue in Nazareth. And he walked in and he read from Isaiah 61, talked about the God's bringing good news to the poor, God's looking to bring release to the captives, the oppressed, and for those who mourn. And it was a positive message. People embraced it. Until we then moved on in that episode to say, and this isn't just for the people of Israel. This is actually for all nations, and even he gives two examples of Naaman and the woman of, I'm going to say Nain, but it's not Nain, but two examples of Gentiles who had been embraced and blessed by God. And that was too much, so he was thrown out of the synagogue and almost thrown over a cliff. And Luke has chosen that as his picture of the message, the ministry, the mission of Jesus. Jesus then has, as we've followed in the last few weeks, gathered the beginnings of his team. Peter, James, John, Andrew, the fishermen, and then others. So he had his 12 team, is that 12 apostles have been gathered. Then he goes to the Sermon on the Plain, as we saw last week, and talks about, this is my way. This is, if you're going to follow me, this is the way, and it's not the way of violence and power, nor is it the way of political control and gathering together influence. It's a third way, an alternate way, the way of grace, the way of loving enemies, of dealing with resentments, of exercising forgiveness. So the disciples and those who are gathering to follow Jesus have heard that. Now, immediately before the transfiguration, in Luke's version, Jesus has been on the road to Caesarea Philippi, asked the question, who do people say that I am? Some say you're John the Baptist, some say you're Elijah. Then Jesus asked the question, who do you say that I am? Peter speaks for all of them and says, you are the Christ. You're the one who we've been promised would be sent. Then Jesus goes into saying, in effect, you're right, I am the Messiah. Doesn't actually say it, but he affirms Peter's response. And for the first time in Luke's gospel, it's actually the same in Mark and Matthew as well, for the first time he moves from the question, who am I, to what have I come to do? He talks about going to Jerusalem, and he's going to be handed over and beaten and killed. And in the other accounts, especially in Matthew, Peter takes offence at that and said, no, Lord, you got it wrong. Let me just remind you what the Messiah is supposed to do. He's supposed to be like David. He's supposed to win. And Luke then brings an episode distinctively, and he says, if you're going to follow me, take up my way, you have to be prepared to give up all the trappings of life. If your life is about gaining as much for yourself, then this is not the way for you. But if you trust me with my way, I will give you life. And so Jesus turns and starts to head to Jerusalem. It is at this point Luke then inserts the transfiguration. As though there's still lingering counts. This is a massive thing to do. A choice to follow Jesus is huge. And it's asking a lot. It's asking everything to trust Jesus in following him. And Jesus is saying it's not going to be easy. Now, the step we take in following hearing the Sermon on the Plain and the teaching that Jesus gives is that it is exceptional teaching. That's why it has lasted over 2,000 years and people still quote parts of it about the power, the richness, how profound it is. But if it was just teaching, it would go into the mix of all the other teachings that we have available to us. And there's no shortage of teachings and wisdom. Some of it's good, some of it's less than good. The one thing that makes a difference is not just saying our way is the best way. It's saying we have a teacher who walked the talk. That is the big difference that separates Jesus from other profound teachers and peacemakers. Jesus lived what he spoke about, of offering forgiveness for his enemies, which he did upon the cross. Jesus realized that it didn't just happen out of goodwill and out of aspirations and let's just try and do better and let's just be nice and kind to each other. Jesus knew that something deeper and more profound needed to happen. It needed to happen between humanity and God, and through the power of what happens between humanity and God, not just individually but collectively, in seeking forgiveness, in experiencing the grace and forgiveness of God, only then are our hearts freed to be able to extend and live in grace and generosity. That is why Jesus is so important, not just because objectively his teaching is so great, because the work that Jesus did to enable those who would follow him. Jesus, more than anyone else, walked the talk. If you want to know what it looks like, look at the life of Jesus. And so we come to this episode of the Transfiguration, this extraordinary moment that is so profound, but challenging to try and work out what is going on here. It was only witnessed by Peter, John, and James. So our account of it comes through them, and they said we fell asleep. In fact, one of Luke's distinctive terms is, yeah, well, they were really asleep. It was just so overwhelming in its energy, perhaps. So it's really hard to work through what is going on in here, and there's a lot of speculation. But one note that we have that can see, and Luke actually highlights this, it is not that we were taken up into heaven, but that heaven broke down upon earth. Heaven broke into that moment in a profound way. That will actually be a foretaste of when heaven fully transforms earth. So this is Luke's account. There's a number of things that are distinctive about it. We've just heard it. It's about 8 days after this conversation, which is on Caesarea Philippi, and Jesus calling people to follow him. But we notice in particular, Luke adds these words, and he went up on the mountain to pray. And he continues, as he was praying. This isn't in Mark, this isn't in Matthew. In fact, Luke does this a number of times, those moments when there is an intentional time of prayer, God works in a powerful way. Luke wants us all to hear that. Prayer matters. When we fail to pray, things don't happen. When we do pray, God hears and responds. So God is just waiting, saying that the prayer switch is there, the power is there, but you need to turn that switch on. You need to pray. We have a prayer meeting coming up, a monthly prayer meeting this Friday. And I'm not just going to sort of say, look, it'd be good to come along. I want to bring a culture of prayer, strengthen our culture of prayer as a church in realizing that God works in and through our prayers. And where we get it wrong, God says, that's okay, I'll get it better, I'll make it. But I want you to pray. And Luke says, when there's an intentionality of prayer and a culture of coming before God and being still before God, things happen. As he was praying, this happens. Luke wants us to hear that. So we have this episode of where heaven touches earth. And then this amazing terminology in Matthew and Mark, they talk about as metamorphosis, actually a whole change of form that comes. Luke actually doesn't use that term. But Luke talks about a glory, a brightness that appears. And it's used in terms that recalls Moses' brightness that would come when he went into the tent of meeting. Back in the book of Exodus, when they were traveling through the wilderness and they had the tabernacle and they had a tent of meeting that Moses would go to. And when Moses came out of the tent of meeting, his face was so radiant, so bright. They said, it's too strong for us. Put a veil over you until you fade down a bit. That is the word that Luke uses of what is going on here, a brightness that is appearing. But it is a profound moment that is captured very much in a lot of, this is an icon from the first few centuries, that this is a profound defining moment that describes beyond all doubt how unique Jesus is. He is the one who was radiant. He is the one who has been sent by God, the man from heaven walking upon earth. So where do we go with this? Another really interesting, and it's often lost in our translations, but it is so important that Luke adds, verse 31, they appeared in glory, this is Moses and Elijah, the two men, and were speaking of his, our text says, departure. The word is exodus, literally exodus. And the word Exodus, of course, brings back the whole story of the Exodus in the Old Testament. The escape from bondage of the Egyptians into freedom. They were talking about Jesus' Exodus, which he was about to accomplish in Jerusalem. They were talking about the mission of Jesus and what lay ahead in that mission. Luke wants us to make the connections. This is God working through Jesus in a world-changing event that Jesus alone was capable and qualified to undertake. Which reminds us then that we, whatever route we take, need to land at the point of Jesus and his mission. We can talk about all sorts of other lovely things, and there's powerful and rich things that we can talk about. But if that pathway does not lead us to the person of Jesus, his mission and ministry, and what he accomplished in Jerusalem, then we have lost it. So where I want to go with this is to highlight the importance of our conversations with our family, of our friends, and our own thoughts, landing at the point of saying, have you really spent time with Jesus? Now, as it happens, the Anglican Church, about 2 years ago, agreed upon a thing called Hope 25, and it's about to commence in this coming week. It is designed to run from Ash Wednesday to Easter within the churches as we focus, remind ourselves, we deepen our roots and our appreciation of the work of Jesus. Then from Easter to Pentecost, we take that message out in any way we can think of to the wider community. In that journey, can I encourage you to spend some time with Jesus? In particular, there is these little booklets are available on our Info Central table. The Gospel of Luke, Hope in an Uncertain World. Even better than taking a copy for yourself and just trying to read a couple of pages, two or three pages a day, maybe two or three of you might take it. So let's read it together. Let's catch up over a coffee, over a tea. Let's have some time. We know the stories. A lot of things are familiar, but things will emerge out of that we hadn't noticed before. But let us look deeply at the person of Jesus, his teaching, his character, his ministry, his mission, and the gospel that emerges out from it. So they're free. They're available. The diocese has made them free. We can get more if people want them. But what better way to spend Lent than just to read our way from beginning to the end through Luke's gospel for yourself? In that context, Hope in an Uncertain World was the theme that was chosen about 2 years ago. I cannot think of a more appropriate way to present the gospel. Looking for the hope in our Lord Jesus Christ in an uncertain world. This is a little video clip that talks about what we're on about and how we can be involved, calls for all of us to be involved.
Our world needs hope. All around us we are faced with uncertainties, rising costs of living, a changing climate,
mental health epidemic,
family violence, wars and religious wars,
instability and fear.
Our world needs hope. Jesus is our hope in an uncertain world.
And we want to share that hope with others.
We're inviting every Anglican church in Australia
to join together to proclaim this hope
between Easter Day and Pentecost 2025.
We'll help you by providing resources and encouragement, free materials and training,
videos and how-to guides to enable you to take part.
Imagine every Anglican church,
every town and city, every suburban community,
all working in the same season,
to proclaim hope in an uncertain world.
We want every person in Australia to know the hope we have in Jesus.
Will you join us?
Will you join us?
This is something that, of course, we should be doing all year, 24 hours a day, 24/7 if you like, but our whole life. But there's an intentionality behind the prayer. And if you haven't signed up already, it's got a terrific page that you can look at on the internet.
All around us.
Still need hope. But encourage, as a church, we've said, yes, we want to be involved in that. We've got a number of things in the pipeline. In coming weeks, you'll hear a bit more about the Create a Church initiative, which is another way of looking at expressing our hope. Paul's going to be talking about a children's choir that we're hoping to encourage not just children with our own connections, but the wider community to come and to sing and to hear more about it. We'll be having an outreach program in May, which is between Easter and Pentecost. And so we've got a number of things working on that, but it's not limited to some of these initiatives. You can think through all manner of things that you might be able to do, whether it's host some friends over to come in to have a Q&A about different questions of faith and belief and other things. There's a heap of resources available on that page. So that is very timely because that's exactly where our passage, where Luke is wanting us to go. Take all those thoughts, those fears, those concerns and bring them to Jesus and follow his way. So as Luke's account continues, they said Peter and those with him were in a deep sleep, and when they became fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men that were standing there. So this glory is just something that is too evocative, too brilliant for us to capture. You can't get an easy photo to try and say, well, that's exactly what it looked like. But it is a radiance, it is an energy, and it is finalized by one of the handful of occasions in the gospel where a heavenly voice speaks, where the Father speaks. While he was saying this, a cloud appeared and overshadowed them. And they became afraid as they entered the cloud. And then a voice came from the cloud saying, "This is my Son, my chosen one. Listen to him." If you want to know what the point of this sermon is today, seek Jesus, listen to Jesus, trust Jesus. When the passage is picked up in a very similar way in our first reading from 2 Corinthians chapter 4, into chapter 3, into chapter 4. But in particular, I just want to highlight that it talks about where whenever a person turns to the Lord, the veil is removed. We suddenly see things more clearly. We see truth, we see the way of Jesus, we see the way of God's purposes of righteousness in the kingdom becomes clearer. And now the Lord is the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. We all, with unveiled faces, are looking as in a mirror at the glory of the Lord and being transformed into the same image from glory to glory, that is the Lord who is Spirit. That phrase is the verse that I wanted to pick up and to really sit with. We can think about the transfiguration. We weren't there. Our minds can just begin to sort of imagine something of that nature, but it is so otherworldish, it's hard for us to imagine. But this verse says that we get drawn in the Spirit into that space. We can experience that same radiance, like looking into a mirror, so that Christ is reflected in us. And there are some people we meet from time to time in the church. You can sense that. You look at them and there's a radiance about their life, their faith. And that is available to all of us if we are prepared to allow those veils to be pulled back. Because the veils were hiding the radiance of God. That's what Moses was doing. The veil was hiding his radiance. If we pull our veils back, then the glory of God can be seen by others in God's grace, only in and through the Spirit. So Paul then continues. Paul has been facing his own challenges, his criticisms. He's not the sort of leader that people were expecting. His journey wasn't full of all the success stories, but he'd struggled, he's been imprisoned. And Paul was almost at a point of saying, it's too much. He actually uses the word, I'm not sufficient, I'm not up to this, Lord, he says, echoing the same words as Moses. But by chapter 4, as Paul has reminded himself, I've seen Christ, I can't say it's too much. So he then says, therefore, since through God's mercy we have this ministry, we do not lose heart. And Paul was not putting this out there just for himself. He's saying it to all churches. He's saying it to us. Through God's mercy, we have this ministry here at St. Matthew's Kensington. We have resources, we have each other, we have the Spirit of God working in us, we have God's grace, and we have God's mercy. So we shouldn't lose heart. But rather, we've renounced secret and shameful ways. We don't need to use deception or distort the word of God. On the contrary, setting forth the truth plainly, we commend ourselves to everyone's conscience in the sight of God, because we are doing our best to say that Jesus is worthy of our trust and our faith, and his way is the best way above all. So let us not this be an otherworldly experience, but a glimpse of the space that we are drawn into. In fact, our gatherings in worship is just a little glimpse of that glory that we remind and encourage each other as we gather weekly, as we enter into God's truth. May it be this Lent, not just because it's a program that we're commanded to do, because it matters. It matters for us, it matters for our world, it matters for our families and our neighbours and our friends, that they get to know and see the glory of Jesus Christ. Amen.